Hey Steve, good to see you. Today's topic, very interesting, actually a huge topic, talking about benefits as they pertain to veterinarians and as part of their veterinary contract, veterinary employment agreement. And this is obviously one of the big things that we spend a lot of time talking to our clients about when we're reviewing one of their contracts.
Yep, everybody gets some, not everybody gets all. Some people get most. We want to kind of go over what we're normally seeing, what the reasoning behind, some of the way it's presented to you is, and kind of talk about what the norms of the industry are currently.
Yeah, and I think that's a big deal that we can provide is we have the opportunity to see three or four of these contracts a day in our little law practice, probably a thousand contracts a year. And we get a pretty good idea of what is common, what's normal, what's industry standard, what's happening out there in the market, and what's being offered to first year veterinarians versus specialists with 20 or 30 years of experience. And so and you said it, right? Not everybody gets every benefit. But benefits in the good news, in the last 5 to 10 years, benefits have grown dramatically in veterinary medicine. When we both started doing this, benefits were essentially non-existent. It was just, here's your salary, here's maybe a little bit of production pay, no bonuses, and very little benefits. The one good thing about corporations and corporate veterinary practice is they have brought benefits into the veterinary space. And that was an argument for a long time is veterinarians and veterinary technicians that are practicing or working for a corporate practice have better benefits. And that's generally true. They brought benefits to the space, but private employers, independently owned practices, have definitely upped their game as far as benefits go. And I would argue at this point, the corporates have kind of actually backed off of their benefits a little bit. And the independent practices have kind of stepped up their game a little bit in the attempts to be able to hire good people. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, it's funny because what I kind of I was thinking to myself, I said Lance is going to say something good about corporates here, so I don't have to, and you did, so thank you for that. But he's absolutely right, and I kind of think about it when you think about these big corporations, like a lot of times veterinary practices is not their only business. They're used to having offices full of employees that get a full suite of benefits, both fringe and otherwise. And they just kind of carried that forward into the veterinary industry. And it became the new normal that then the private practices are like, we better catch up to them and at least offer, a solid fringe benefits package so we have are able to compete when we know that they're going to be able to offer a higher signing bonus, probably, and maybe even better compensation. So we better at least get to where we can be on the benefits, so we're kind of on equal footing there, and then maybe win the people over with our culture rather than an increase in compensation or a signing bonus or something like that.
Yeah, just sheer money. But let's take a step back, Steve, and talk a little bit. We're using this word benefits a lot. What does that actually mean? And so what we're talking about here specifically are non-taxable compensation pieces. And so money that's coming from the employer to the employee in the form of something that the employee needs. And benefits are a very defined term when it comes to IRS code and other taxation, kind of entities. And so when we're talking about benefits, we're talking about non-taxable compensation, non-wage benefits. That's the technical word for it. And I want to take a step even further back. And so as we're looking at a job offer, or a contract, employment agreement, whatever you want to call it, there's one section of it that is taxable wages. And so that means that, hey, that's the money that's coming from the employer to the employee in the form of a W-2. That's that little slip of paper that you get at the end of the year that says this is how much compensation you received, taxable compensation. This is how much you paid in taxes already, and here's your unemployment insurance and all these other things that have been taken out of your paycheck. That's your W-2. And so there's a line on that W-2 that says exactly to the penny how much compensation that you received. Both salary and production is included in that W-2. This thing that we're talking about today, benefits, non-taxable benefits, are not included in that W-2. So we're all incentivized to maximize our benefits packages because it's a way for the practice to pay the associate to for their services, right? To provide them these certain things in a non-taxable format. Otherwise, everybody would just pay, hey, here's your $140,000, and you can go buy those benefits as you need. If the benefits are moved over in this non-taxable manner, then the employee doesn't pay any taxes. The practice is a common question. The practice still gets the same deduction, right? So they're not losing any money or paying any more taxes on it. They're actually paying a little bit less taxes because they don't pay their portion of the employer's taxes, right? So the employer's payroll taxes. So moving, if it's hard to understand all this, moving compensation from your W-2 wages over to your benefits package benefits everybody. Now, once we take that, we have our W-2 wages, and then we have our benefits package that totals this kind of concept of total compensation, right? So we add these two things up, and we want to think about these contracts, and we want to think about the offer in terms of total compensation, right? What is my guaranteed base? Okay, what's the chances of me making production? And then what benefits packages or what benefits are coming to me, and what value do those benefits include for me? So then in that way, when you're comparing three, four, five different offers, you're comparing apples to apples, right? If you just look at the salaries, it's going to be apples to oranges because almost every one of these compensation packages has di a different benefits schedule to it. And the last thing that I'll say on this, Steve, is these are super negotiable. I want everyone to view benefits as theirs, right? It's their thing that they're receiving. It's not just this gift that comes from the practice. You're performing services for those benefits, and so it's essentially your money, right? And you get to decide on where you put it in. So there's a common misconception: well, these aren't negotiable. They're all the same. The corporate won't listen to me about it. That is not true. We see some of the biggest negotiation and the biggest movements in negotiation on benefits. Now, having said that, a couple of things aren't necessarily negotiable. And Steve, I'll let you tell what you usually run into there.
That's right, what I was getting at. Perfect setup. So, like, there, yes, and Lance is right. The vast majority of the fringe benefits are negotiable within the employment agreement. But a couple of things jump out to me that are not. And usually you'll see them listed in an agreement as saying, employees eligible for all benefit programs that the practice may offer to all similarly situated employees. So, what does that mean? It means you're going to have access to the health insurance, the medical insurance, and that is non-negotiable because it's the same for everybody. Everybody gets the
Yeah.
same plan.
And I'll stop you right there, Steve, on this point, and we'll come back to that. On this point, because of the Affordable Care Act and because of the way that health insurance plans are written, basically all employees have to be the same. And so if it's a large company with 4,000 employees, they're not going to change all of their health insurance plans because you want something different. You have access to the health insurance plan. It's not going to be rewritten. It's the way that it is because it's baked into the law from the Affordable Care Act. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, and even think about their a corporate health insurance policy. They're not going to say, oh, we pay 50% of everybody else's deductible, but we pay 75% of yours. That's not something that's going to happen. And that is something that we will see within the medical that can be variable. They may pay for 100% of your plan, 75, 50, something else.
Yeah.
And that's up to you to ask and find out. So one of the things we want to do is, if you're going to be electing, we would advise, even though you can't change it, let's get the information, let's get the benefit plans, let's see what they look like, so you can at least have that in your pamphlet of offers here, so you can compare that kind of thing between the practices.
Yeah. And the only way to really get that information is to ask for the plan. That's what it's called because it's a health insurance plan. And that allows you to look at all the options, what deductibles are there, what your co-pays are, what's in your network, what's out of your network. Those are all very important details to understand, hey, what is my health insurance benefit? Even before you accept the offer, right? I want to know this because it obviously plays into your total compensation. All right, one that's semi not negotiable is your health insurance. And the second one, Steve, go ahead.
It's going to be your retirement plan, the 401k, the simple IRA, whatever it is that practice is offering. You don't like that they have a 2% match, they can't go change it because you say, hey, I need a 4% match. Everybody already has a 2% match. They've already signed their plan documents. That's when all that thing is negotiated between the plan provider and the practice. It is what it is. They can't alter the vesting schedule. They can't change when you become eligible for it. They can't change the percentage. If they do end up changing the percentage or any of that, it'll change for everybody.
Yep. Yeah. So to speak figuratively, you know, that cake has already been baked, right? So that plan has already been set, and it's set semi in stone. And so the employee basically has to accept, hey, this is what my health insurance plan is. Now, I want to tease a couple of things out of what Steve said. So here are some of the variables that we see folks play with, right? And that is, you know, the match. How much match is there? Typically, we see at least 3% match. Some practices will go up to 4.5%. I mean, that's really what's allowed by, you know, under law. And what I'm talking about as far as match here goes is of the employee. So the employee has to go first, right? They have to put in their money first. And let's just use round numbers for the sake of my simple math, right? So let's say an employee is making $100,000, and they have a 3% match. That means that if they put in $3,000 per year, 3% of $100,000, then the practice will come and match with another 3%. So at the end of the year, in that employee's investment retirement account, and specifically what we're talking about here is 401ks, in that veterinarian's 401k, there will be $6,000, three of which came from the employee, three of which came from the employer, the practice, right? But the employee has to go first. They have to put their money in to start this match process. And so when Steve and I are talking about 3%, 4%, 4.5%, that's what we're talking about, a certain percentage of the employee's W-2 wages. That term that we talked about 5 minutes ago, that's where this comes into a lot of importance. The other thing that Steve talked about is vesting. And so vesting is this word that basically means once an employee has vested, once they have been at the practice, the company for a certain amount of time, then the money is theirs. And this is a very important concept. So if there's a 5-year vesting, and some refer to this as a 5-year vesting cliff, that means that the practice is putting this money in year after year, all right? $3,000 every year. Maybe it's going to be more than that if you're making more W-2 wages, right? And you should be, honestly. All right. So at the end of 5 years, we may have $20,000 or $30,000 that's in that account, but it's not actually the employees until they work until that vesting requirement. All right. Another way to call vesting, just like kind of the colloquial term, is golden handcuffs, right? And so if an employee has a bunch of money sitting in this non-vested account, well, they don't get that money until they work there for a certain number of years. And so they're incentivized to continue to work for the company. And that's why it's called golden handcuffs. But the word that you'll see in the plan is this concept of vesting. And so these are important concepts, right? So if you're only planning on working for the employer for a year or two or three, and it's got a 5-year vesting, well, that money's not going to do any good. I do want to really point out, though, that the money that the employee, that the veterinarian puts in, is always vested, right? So that's your money, and you get to take it back, right? It's in your account. I'm only when we're talking about vesting, we're only talking about the employer's portion of the match, right? So those funds are separated in the account, and the employer has the ability to pull that non-vested out. See, what do you commonly see on vesting requirements in these 401ks?
So hold up. You mean that after the practice puts that 3,000 into my account, I can't just quit and take it all with
You can't take it with you. It's not your money until you've worked there
Man,
for a certain amount of time. I
I'm
know
so
that's a
demanding.
question you commonly get, Steve.
All the time, all the time. And the one thing I'll piggyback on with vesting is, you know, it kind of varies. You know, the best is clearly immediate vesting. So, you know, the practice, and I feel like we're doing an investment banking, you know, podcast now, but you know, you immediate vesting, every dollar they put in is yours immediately. But let's say it's a 4-year vesting, and so each year that you work, 25% of their contribution vests. You go through year one, you decide you don't like it, you quit, they put the 4,000 in, you get to keep 750 of it, the rest of it goes back to the practice. After year two, they've put in $6,000. You don't make it to the end of year three. Now you got to split that 6,000 in half because we are now 50% vested. You get to keep half, they get to take half. And it just kind of goes upward from there until you hit that point where yay, you've hit the 4, the 5, the 3 years, and now every dollar they put in thereafter is yours immediately. And we're seeing, you know, top out of 6 years, low of immediate, which puts 3 years kind of right in the middle of what we're seeing.
A vesting. So vesting. The point being is, you know, to those associates out there, you've got to really pay attention to the vesting and what the vesting requirements are. Just because they say, oh, hey, it's great, we get a 4.5% match, it's like, when is that money actually mine? And so that's a very important detail. The third important detail on the 401k or IRA here is, when are you eligible to start? And so sometimes it's an immediate start. I'll let you finish this. Sometimes that starts not for 12 months, Steve.
Yeah. And sometimes, or even what you'll see, okay, you can contribute right away, but we're not going to match for 12 months. You know, you can contribute, and that those are where we see the 6 year vestings, because it's the first year they're not putting in any money anyway, but they still count it as a year of vesting. And then you have a 5 year, 20% each year up to the end of the 5 years. You know, yeah. And it's, I really would like to see people become eligible within the first 90 days. That's ideal, you know, but, you know, sometimes we do see the 1 year outs. And now I don't know that that's anything that makes anybody walk away from an employment contract at a practice they really, really want to work at, but at least be aware of it. Just ask for the plan information so you can take a look at it and figure out those three items.
Yeah. I mean, if all things were the same and one practice had immediate start and one was a delayed start of the 401k for a year, you know, you would probably take the year, you know, or the immediate start. Right. And so, you know, it's one of those things. It's a thing that needs to go into the equation. It's a thing that associates need to understand, and how is that going to impact their financial future, et cetera. So those are the two things that we don't see a lot of negotiation on. So we've covered health insurance and we covered 401ks. I guess I should take a step back for a second, Steve, for a second. Here, we're talking specifically about 401ks. I will often get a question about a Roth IRA or something along those lines. Those are paid with after-tax dollars. So you're always free to do that, right? So the growth in a Roth IRA is tax-free. What we're talking about here are 401ks, which is also an investment retirement account. I know I'm throwing a lot of soup, alphabet soup out there, but the 401k, the money goes in tax-free. It grows and it comes out later on as taxable income. With a Roth IRA, it's completely opposite, right? So people often ask me, well, you know, can I do a Roth IRA through my company? It's kind of pointless. You don't have to do that, because you can go do that on your own, because it's always with after tax dollars. There's not a law in the books that says that that can be with pre-tax dollars. All right. So that's our health insurance and our 401ks. All right. And so some other things that we kind of need to cover a little bit, Steve, or other lists that we're kind of going through the checklist of potential benefits. Another one would be a health reimbursement account, or a health savings account, or a flexible spending account. All right. And so these are very important vehicles for savings in the terms of the health savings account, HSA, the key word being the S, the savings. But that's also opposed to a flexible spending account, the key word being spending. So a savings account, a health savings account, means that at the end of the year, if you still have that money in that account, then it rolls over to the next year, hence the word savings. A flexible spending account, again, spending, you have to spend all that money in the same year. And so the money doesn't roll over. It's a use it or lose it situation. All right. They both are FSA and FSA and HSA, so they can be kind of confusing, but massive differences in the way that these plans operate. We obviously really want to push for an HSA, because that can build some long-term savings, and you may not get sick in year one, year two, year three, but I have to break it to everyone. Eventually we will get sick, and eventually you'll use that money. And so it's a very good, you know, savings vehicle for young and healthy people. Little caveat there, you have to have a high deductible health plan to qualify for a health savings account. It's designed to help the veterinarian, or help people, pay their deductible. And so if you have a low deductible plan, then it's not allowed under the law there. So health savings account, kind of backing up to health insurance, you know, just a little bit. I do want to point out as well, I'm throwing a lot of little caveats here, for very small practices, like independently owned practices, have 5, 10, 15 employees, they can form what's called a health reimbursement account. So basically they can reimburse the employee for the cost of their health insurance. And so it's a pretty cool little vehicle. Not everybody knows that it's out there, but if you're in an independently owned practice, small employer, then they might have that option, or you might present that option to them and say, "Hey, can we go do this?" And so I can get some of my health insurance paid for. If you're in a large employer, the Affordable Care Act affects every business that is greater than 50 employees. And so if they have more than 50 employees, then they're going to have a health plan per the Affordable Care Act. All right, so anything else you can think of on health stuff or
I
in
did.
investment retirement accounts, Steve?
I did think of one more. I did think of one more thing. Two more things. One on each topic. So for health insurance, what about when an employer says we will provide you with a stipend of X dollars a month for you to go and purchase your own health insurance? How does that work?
Yeah, so if it's not in one of these qualified health reimbursement plans, QRSA, then it's probably going to be taxable. And so keep in mind here, what we're trying to get to is non-taxable income. If they want to call it, if they want to call it a health reimbursement, that's probably going to be a taxable event. And unfortunately, the only way to really find that out is under an audit, which is not too much fun.
And on the retirement plans, I'm thinking, what about a smaller practice that offers a safe harbor plan? One thing I routinely see with the safe harbor plans is when I see those words, I'm like, ooh, immediate vesting.
Yep. So it's going to qualify immediately there. All right. So that's your health insurance. That's your investment retirement accounts. We talked about HSAs. Now let's talk a little bit about other insurances. And so other insurances would include vision and dental, which a lot of larger practices offer. When they say you have access to it, I mean, hopefully your experiences with mine, Steve, is generally, you're going to pay for it. The practice very rarely pays for it. It's the employee pays for it by a paycheck deduction.
Yes.
It's usually pretty inexpensive. We're talking, $20 a month or something along those lines. But it's one of those things where you want to do the math here, right? So like, if you don't really need dental insurance and you can go get a dental cleaning for, $150, then okay, why am I going to pay $240 a year, for dental insurance? And so do the math on that before you automatically just do it. But if you're like a person that has a lot of cavities and needs dental insurance, then that's a whole nother ball game. Same thing with it with vision as well. So sometimes you can pay out of pocket. Sometimes it's better to to pay for the insurance there. All right, so that's vision, dental. We also see life insurance occasionally. Just want to point out that on this life insurance thing, the maximum benefit, meaning if you die, your beneficiaries will only get $50,000. So it's not a huge benefit. It's really pretty inexpensive, but a lot of practices do provide it. The last thing I want to point out here, Steve, on insurances is your professional liability insurance. And so this, some people refer to this as malpractice insurance. This one is a big one that has changed in the last 5 or 6 years. Used to be, and I know we talk about the old days, right? But used to be that practices would just gladly pay for the veterinarian's, professional liability insurance, usually through AVMA PLIT. But at this point, especially among the corporate practices, we usually don't see that. We usually see that you will have access to a group plan, or you'll have, there'll be some sort of other plan that's out there. I know that this is one of those things that you see in almost every contract, Steve, but kind of speak to the commonality of these group plans at this point.
And the way you'll see it worded very, very cleanly, we'll provide you with professional liability insurance that will cover you under the scope of your employment at this practice or this group of practice or any practice in this corporation. But if you want to go do a relief shift, it's not going to cover you. So it is covering you in the practice itself. It's not like an AVMA PLIT policy, which will cover the veterinarian where they are practicing.
Yeah, so this is a huge point, right? So if you're not paying attention right now, pay attention for the next few seconds here. All right, so you want an insurance policy, not want, you have to have an insurance policy on it, meaning that you have your own policy that follows you if you go pick up relief, like Steve said, if you go pick up Moonlight, if you go palpate, cattle at a sale barn, right? You have to have that policy that follows you wherever you go. And so we actually want to see it in the paperwork in your contract that says you have a health insurance or you have a professional liability policy in your name. So we can look at a piece of paper and see your name on it. All right, most corporations at this point will not allow that to happen. They will say, we already offer you insurance. We don't have to offer you more professional liability insurance. They don't usually give on that negotiation point because they have negotiated a big policy for all 1,000 doctors or 2,000 doctors or whatever the situation is. Here's the other big caveat, or here's the other big important point. So again, if you're not paying attention, this is the one you want to pay attention to. If you are in a group practice, meaning that there's two, three, four, five doctors, especially if you're on an urgent care or an emergency care practice, you have to have a policy in your own name. What we see happen over on the malpractice side is when there's a complaint, when there's an issue, when there's a bad outcome, and there will be, that's an unfortunate truth of life, right? And when there's a lawsuit, it's not if, when there's a lawsuit, if you have a group policy for all 7, 8, 10 doctors at the practice, you get one lawyer. All right. So we have seven different stories and seven different touch points on that patient and that client, but one lawyer is trying to represent all of them, which is obviously creates a conflict of interest immediately. Here's the problem is that lawyer is incentivized to throw somebody under the bus, right? And that person is usually the most junior associate. You know, so the most senior associates, the medical directors and all chiefs of staff, you know, they basically turn and blame the most junior associate that this thing happened. They're the one that caused this error. It seems really unfair because it is. And so if you, the junior associate, had your own policy in your own name, you would have your own legal representation during that policy or during that complaint or that lawsuit. And that attorney would say, whoa, no, you're not throwing my client under the bus. You're going to have to prove it. And so very much you really want to pay attention to these, and you definitely want to make sure that you have your own policy with your own name on it. Let's see, Steve, we also need to talk a little bit about licenses and registration. That's a common one that practices do pay for. And so they'll usually pay for the state veterinary license. They'll state pay for the DEA registration, which by the way is about 900 bucks now. It's pretty expensive. 900 bucks for 3 years. Again, that's a after tax benefit, right? And then they'll usually pay for some association dues as well. So like your state VMA, possibly the AVMA at large. If you're an AAFP member or an AABP member, they'll throw some dues, you know, at you there. Usually it's like one or two, you know, associations of your choosing. Is that what you usually see as well?
Yeah, I really like to see three because ideally I'd like to see AVMA, I'd like to see the state, and I'd like to see, you know, an organization of your choice based on, like you said, AAFP, AAEP, or
Emergency critical care.
something emergency critical care, something in your specialty, that kind of thing. Yes, the state license, the DEA registration. You know, sometimes we will see things on the DEA registration where it'll say, hey, we'll pay for this, but because it's a 3-year license, if you're not here for 3 years, we're going to claw back that time period that you were not here. So you leave after 1 year, you're going to need to pay us back for 2/3 of that license because we laid out for the 3 years.
Yeah, I can kind of understand that
I
to an
get it.
extent. You know, that's there. What do you think? That's probably in there 20, 25% of the time, something like that.
Probably. And it's more the smaller practices that are doing that. The bigger corporations are not trying to chase people around for that kind of thing for the most part. We'll also, and sometimes you've got to be on the really be on the lookout in these benefits clauses. Sometimes at the very end it might say, hey, we're going to claw back a prorated portion of everything. Your license, if you have a 2-year license or even your annual AVMA, hey, you only were here 6 months. You know, so that's something we really do just want to make sure is if it's there, we want to let you know, maybe see if we can get rid of that. If it's not there, you know, we'll just kind of move along, you know.
And so
But
all of these so far are super common, right? So this is what we pretty much expect and see, you know, over and over and over again. The next one would be CE benefits. And so the practice is going to provide a certain amount of money for the veterinarian to go receive continuing education. You know, and this means that it could be for the registration of the meeting, online registration, if that's the case. It definitely could be, you know, it definitely could be the hotel registration, airfare, you know, travel, mileage reimbursement, meals. All of this can be included in that continuing education allowance, right? And see, what do you typically see in that allowance at this point?
Yeah, and there's a couple of things when I think about allowances. We were for a long time seeing GP at 2,000, and I'm seeing that trend up to 2,500 probably in the last 3 to 6 months for GP. ER has been at 2,500 for a while. I haven't really been seeing that trend towards three yet, though. And we're seeing specialists have a wider range. So anywhere from 3 to 5K is what I'm kind of seeing for specialists. When you talk about allowance, though, there are some practices that say, here's $5,000, figure it out yourself.
And we kind of refer to those as slush funds, right? And I don't really
Cafeteria
like the slush
fund,
fund. Yeah,
a
cafeteria.
la
So
carte.
yeah, so when they put all this money together and say, here's $5,000, that covers your CE, that covers your license, that covers your association, that covers your
Okay.
DEA registration, you should be able to buy all that stuff with this. Well, when you actually do the math, it doesn't add up to
Never.
the month. So we actually want to separate this all out, and not use this quote unquote slush fund that we just pile all this stuff together. It always works out better for the veterinarian if we separate these things out. You know, and so we obviously, this is usually an easy negotiation win on the CE allowance, is because we ask for more and more, because obviously CE benefits both parties. Okay, you get to go learn something new, you get to bring a skill back to the practice. The practice will benefit from that by you offering additional services. So you have to kind of connect the dots, right? That this is a good thing for the practice. Let me ask for more of this, especially if you have something certain in mind, right? Like, I want to go to this specific dental CE. I want to go to this specific echocardiogram CE. You know, if you're using your CE dollars on something that's going to specifically benefit the practice, then the practice is usually has a pretty hard time saying no. We see people ask for acupuncture training, chiropractic training, specialized surgical training, specialized dental training. Those are all fair game in this negotiation. If you can pick something out, do the homework of how much it's going to cost, where do you need to stay in hotels, how much time do you need off, and come with a plan, the practice will usually say yes to that. You know, rather than, hey, I'm just going to go have a good time in Orlando for a week and you're going to pay for it. That's a different conversation than I'm going to bring something back that's very, very useful. Let's see, there's one other one, Steve, that we need to talk about before we break and come back to other stuff later on. And that is disability insurance. All right. So we will often see disability. I wouldn't say often, maybe 30, 40% of the time, we'll see disability insurance in these contracts. And this is the one of the only times that we say, no, we actually don't want it in the contract. No, we actually don't want the employer to pay for the disability insurance with after-tax dollars. Because if the premium is paid with after-tax dollars, then the benefit becomes taxable. So the people that really like this are disability insurance salespeople, right? Because it's kind of baked into your employment and you're going to have to get it, and the money's coming out of your paycheck before you even see it, right? And so, but what happens is, if the employee actually becomes injured and they actually need the money, right? They need the benefit. Well, then it's subject to taxes, which is a much higher amount, right? So we would rather pay the taxes on the smaller premium amount when we don't actually need the money than pay the taxes when we actually need the money and it's a much larger account. So that's the only time that you'll hear me say, pay the taxes that actually is beneficial to you, is the disability insurance. And so when we see disability insurance in a contract, we actually want to negotiate it out, or at least say, okay, I'll pay taxes on it, make that a taxable thing so I don't get taxed if I actually ever need it. So that's kind of a down and dirty on what the list of benefits are. Typically, we'll see these once we put dollars to this. Okay, this insurance costs this insurance costs that. It's pretty easy to get to a benefit package that's about $20,000 in GP. $20,000, $25,000 kind of rings a bell to me. If you get into the specialist world, then we'll commonly see benefits packages of $30,000 and $35,000. Everything's kind of amped up a little bit, larger amounts and all of that stuff. So the bottom line is you take your wage compensation, you add this $20,000 or $25,000 to it, and then you get this total of your total compensation. You assign a dollar value, and we can talk about that in a different episode as well. What are the dollar values of all these benefits? And then we get to this total compensation package that's, more than just the general wage compensation. All of these are super negotiable. That's a take-home point, right? All of them except for the health insurance and the 401k, right? So everything else that we listed are super negotiable. It's just a function of knowing what to ask for and how to ask for it.
Yeah, and I will say there's one big benefit we left out. We're going to cover it in a future episode soon. Be on the lookout for leave, PTO, maternity leave, sick, vacation, personal.
Yeah,
We're going to cover that's a
that's a
whole thing.
whole conversation to itself. And so we're talking about wage, or we're talking about money benefits here, but the whole time off, pay time off, that's a whole separate set of benefits. All right. Well,
See that
Steve,
soon. So
it's been fun. Big topic here on benefits. And next time we come back, we'll talk about paid leave.
see y'all next time.